So I would also very much like to welcome all of you. A lot of familiar faces here, and that's very heartening to see people return and to see that dedication to placing this path and this teaching of understanding so centrally in your life. And for those of you who are new, I also really welcome you, and I hope that you'll find some a little bit of a refuge here over this weekend. I'm always so grateful to London Insight, and you know, I'm very, very aware I arrived here fairly early this morning to just see the effort that goes into creating a space for all of us. And I'm sure you all recognize in the midst of London, this is kind of quite a special space to have some green and a little bit of quietude. So a weekend, I'm also I feel very privileged to have the weekend to teach here because it allows a kind of development of a theme, a focus on a theme over a couple of days. So again, just a little bit of a few words about the structure of the weekend. I will be offering some teaching on the theme. I don't know if any of you actually read the brochure, but the theme is around the path of liberation, the path of awakening, and what that means to us in our own lives. So I will be doing some teaching around that. We will have periods of quiet sitting. We will have periods of walking. It'll be periods of some allowing some time for some questions and discussion. I would very much encourage you to hold the day within the time frame that we've scheduled, to actually hold that day in silence, so that we have lunch in silence. We allow a little bit of space for us all just to quiet down a little. And there is time at the end of the day to have tea and to network and to communicate. And we really encourage you to stay for that. London Insight, I think, has made a remarkable contribution in the lives of many people to begin to develop a sense of community, a sense of being able to meet together with people of like minds and similar aspirations. And that, for many people in their lives, is something that is sorely lacking. So, again, really taking, if you can, the time to stay for that. So, the theme of this weekend that I will continue through over both days is to really focus on our understanding of what is meant, not only in this tradition, but of course in many traditions, what it really means to live with a liberated heart, to know a dimension of inner freedom, to live with a quality of awakening that is quite timeless and that has been central in all great spiritual traditions over time. It is a teaching, it is a path, it is a seeking that has, you know, through centuries, drawn people to caves on mountaintops and monasteries and, you know, midst of deserts to really understand that genuine freedom of heart. Now, here we are in the lives that we all live. Lives of considerable complexity. Lives where there's many demands, expectations that we're being asked to meet. We don't have the luxury of monasticism, most of us. We've chosen a life of being engaged with the world. And what does that mean for us to live that life in a wakeful way, in a free way? So the Buddha is something that I would be drawing primarily on, the Buddha's teachings around liberation. These are very human teachings. These are not Buddhist teachings. These are very human teachings. But the Buddha very explicitly placed awakening, placed liberation, really at the heart of everything that he taught. The word in Pali, many of you will be familiar with, is nibbana. It is about blowing out the fires. Doesn't mean emptying our life, passion or dedication or commitment, but it is about blowing out the fires of greed, of hatred, of delusion. It's about blowing out the fires of the patterns that have profound effects in our lives, in terms of alienation, in terms of perpetuating fear, in terms of creating separation and unease on a moment-to-moment level. The Buddha was very clear in this, that although he stressed very much the foundation of ethics and integrity, he said, we do not practice alone for the perfection of ethics or integrity. Although he gave remarkable emphasis to the development of inner stillness and the capacity of our minds for attentiveness and collectedness and one-pointedness, he said, we don't practice this path for the sake of concentration alone. But that we undertake this inner exploration and the exploration of what that inner freedom means in the rest of our lives, in the service of developing really an unshakable liberation of the heart. Now, if you were to go to the some of the early texts of the Buddha's teaching, apparently he would give a Dharma talk on liberation and they would say, you know, there were immediately 500 liberated people. And as far as I can see, 500 is a sort of generic term for a lot. But clearly there is something about being able to absorb the teaching, being able to understand the teaching, being able to hear the teaching, which actually really has a powerful effect on informing our own investigation and our own inquiry. This quality of unshakable liberation of the heart, you know, it's not like there's one way. You know, certainly in Buddhist teaching, there's a number of doorways that I talked about. The doorways of faith. The doorways of cultivating unshakable kindness and friendliness and metta. But the primary doorway that is spoken about is the doorway of understanding, the doorway of insight, not of adopting an ideology or a belief system, but of really understanding the pathways of our own hearts and minds, the ways that we relate to the world, the ways that we relate inwardly, moment to moment in our life. Now I think, you know, people in the Western world often have a very ambivalent relationship to this possibility or teaching of liberation. This is actually something quite different in Asia. You know, if you went to Thailand or to Burma, you know, and you rolled up at the gates of a monastery and asked the abbot, you know, any liberated people here? And they say, well, just down there, you know, there's Joe, and over there, there's Sally, you know, and over there, you know, there's Rosemary's doing pretty well. You know, it's kind of like ordinary language. It's ordinary language. Whereas I think sometimes in the Western world, we've actually kind of, in a way, romanticized and idealized awakening and liberation. Sometimes even to the extent that we've kind of disenfranchised ourselves from that possibility. And yet, we have often this ambivalent relationship. And in a way, what I'd like to do over this weekend is to kind of normalize awakening, or to bring it into the realm of possibility, of a genuine and a kind of realistic aspiration. Because we see in ourselves, I'm sure, in moments of stillness, and in moments when we actually really do kind of take times to pause in our life, probably most of us would really deeply acknowledge that longing for wakefulness. Even when we don't have the language for it, or we have very different languages for it, we probably all recognize and acknowledge our longing to live in a way where we feel fully alive, responsive, where we actually acknowledge and are longing for a degree of inner freedom. Most of us really long to live a life where we don't feel it's always marked by confusion and bewilderment and conflict. And we recognize that awakening, as it's spoken about, is not an emotionally neutral space. When we speak about awakening or the liberation of the heart and mind, we're actually speaking about the way that that manifests in unshakable joy, kindness, compassion, peace, equanimity. I think what is there's a rather something which of some sadness, I think, in the way that many traditions have come into the West, in that often there can be a tendency to approach this path and this possibility with an almost a deflated sense of possibility inwardly. I mean, of course, there are problems and issues in any path when a person approaches it, you know, kind of really driven by striving and achievement and becoming. You know, this brings its own set of problems. But there is as much a problem in approaching this path of deepening, this path of exploration, with a deflated sense of capacity. Or a possibility. You sort of imagine awakening as something reserved for a spiritual elite. You know, those who are able to, you know, be on retreat forever, you know, or those who live in monasteries, or certainly reserved for those who have a different mind and body than our own. So our tendency is to think of liberation with a capital L, awakening with a capital A, nirvana with a capital N. And, you know, when we look at the nature of our life, and for many people, you know, I'm very aware of, you know, just how challenging it is just to be able to get through a single day. You know, to get to work, to meet the demands, to meet the responsibilities, to even find a moment of stillness, and how much in our culture, you know, a kind of chronic busyness and fatigue besets the lives of so many. And we imagine that excludes us. We imagine that excludes us. The Buddha actually didn't require retirement as a prerequisite for awakening. That's actually good to know. And doesn't have to wait for those golden moments when suddenly life is empty of demand or responsibility. The Buddha didn't define awakening as a monastic experience, but something that hinges upon a journey of investigation and understanding that we undertake in every moment of our life. And our life is our classroom. Our life is our classroom. Our relationships are our classroom. How we dedicate our time and our attention. This is our classroom. our emotional world, our psychological world. This is our classroom. Awakening is not about some esoteric, transcendent domain, but actually about what is happening right now for us. What is guiding our life? What is our sense of aspiration? What is our sense of direction? What are the values that truly inform how we speak, act, think, and choose? Now, Nibbana or awakening, it lies within this context, as many of you will know, of what are called the four ennobling truths. And Nibbana is the third. Awakening is the third of the ennobling truths. But this third of the ennobling truths cannot in any way be separated from the other three. It's not about an experience, somehow abstracted from the moment-to-moment realities of our lives, but understanding the moment-to-moment realities of our lives. Look at the other three ennobling truths. They begin with understanding what is called in Pali, dukkha. And again, this is an almost untranslatable word, which sadly is sometimes translated as suffering. It is a terrible translation. I think dukkha actually describes it. It describes really some of the threads that we find in our experience. They're personal stories and they're universal stories. Sometimes it's an existential discontent. Just the feeling that there's just something a little bit missing. Something a little bit incomplete. Sometimes dukkha is a kind of bewilderment. You know, we find ourselves falling into holes over and over again. And there's that sense of, how did that happen? You know, how did I end up in this kind of state of confusion or this state of disconnection or this state of alienation? You know, this kind of sense of mystification. Part of dukkha embraces the simple reality of being a human being and living in a body. It's sometimes described as dukkha-dukkha, you know, the pain of pain. You know, it ranges from the sort of, you know, the extremities of aging and illness and death to just waking up in the morning and you've got that niggling ache over there and that tooth is not quite right, you know, and you're wondering what's going on in your back. You know, these are personal stories. These are universal stories. None of us are exempt. Another dimension of dukkha really refers to the reality that we live in a world of instability, changing processes and conditions, arisings and passings, beginnings and endings, not much of which we can't control. We couldn't determine that the sun would shine this morning. We couldn't determine that our children are happy. We can't determine that the experience that we want will turn out the way we want it to be. We go on vacation and it doesn't look like it's said in the brochure. You know, this is kind of the dukkha of instability, the dukkha of conditions. And then the third dimension of dukkha, which is what this path of awakening is truly concerned with, is concerned with our reactions to all of this. This is where we get into states of rejection, argument, denial, aversion, anxiety, blame, shame, should, demand, insistence, how we need things to be. It is a kind of narrative. It is a story about what is going on that is superimposed upon each moment. This is where we actually struggle more than anything else. Loss can indeed be sad. It's not emotionally neutral. Change is often unwelcome. It's not emotionally neutral. Change is sometimes very welcome. It's not emotionally neutral. The body experiences many things we don't always welcome. It's not emotionally neutral. There can be sadness within this world of change, of body, of conditions. Sadness is part of our emotional spectrum. It's part of our capacity for empathy. It can lead to a great sense of compassion, of kindness. It doesn't necessarily lead to confusion. But the third domain of dukkha, where we really get into trouble, is what the path of awakening and liberation is really concerned with. Can we actually liberate the moment? Can we liberate our own hearts, our own mind, from this world of reactivity where we find ourselves imprisoned by patterns of fear, patterns of confusion, patterns of anger, patterns of rage, patterns of blame? This is what is considered to be optional. This is what our journey is actually dedicated to. And not actually at some future moment, but in the present moment. The whole kind of direction of this path is not about, you know, postponement. You know, it's going to be a better moment to be awake in, I'm sure, you know. Better moment to be kind in, I'm sure, when that difficult person has gone away, you know. Better moment to find calmness in after this kind of moment of confusion or chaos has passed. It is about a present moment experience. And certainly I think I have always found one of the great gifts within this teaching is that it is a teaching of process and verbs. It's not a teaching of nouns. It's not a teaching of states. So it is really a teaching of how do we actually liberate the moment? How do we awaken the moment? How do we liberate this present moment we are in from confusion, from greed, from hatred, from alienation? And personally, you know, I think it is not an inflated thing or an overdramatic thing. For anyone who engages in this path of exploration, introspection, deepening, meditation, to think that we are training ourselves in nibbana. That it is a training of awakening. That is a pathway of liberation that is concerned with every event and experience in our life. Now, in Western, in the kind of insight tradition that has, it's really a kind of a pretty much a newcomer, we might say, in this sort of historical development of meditation and Buddhism, to have this creature we kind of call the insight tradition. It's a hybrid of many forms, of many styles, many approaches to practice and understanding. But I would say that there are two primary teachings that have informed the insight tradition. One of these is the teaching of metta, befriending, kindness, care, our willingness to stand next to all experience and events with kindness and with care. This is a primary attitude in meditation practice. Without it, I don't think that it deepens at all. Without this underlying attitude of befriending, I think what we're left with is a kind of cold stare of attention. So this is the primary underpinning of the whole of the path. And again, this is something that is cultivated moment to moment in our life. It is the primary work of metta, in terms of befriending, in terms of insight, is to uproot the very toxic pattern of aversion. Our tendency to dissociate, to disconnect, to push away, to judge, to blame, to shame, to resist, to be impatient with, to be willing to stand near to all experiences and events with a kind curiosity. What is actually going on here? But of course, the second discourse, which is really informed insight practice, is called the Satipatthana teaching, the four ways of establishing mindfulness in the body, in feeling, in the mind, in all processes that appear. And this teaching begins with a very simple and yet pretty radical statement that there is a direct way for the overcoming of sorrow and lamentation and despair, for the overcoming of pain. There is a direct way to the liberation of the heart, and it is through these four ways of establishing mindfulness. These four ways of establishing mindfulness, of course, are concerned with where we are and how we are right now. In the midst of this, we learn to place ourselves, to develop some stillness, to develop some curiosity, and to develop some intimacy with our moment-to-moment experience. And exploring within that, what is it to awaken this moment? What is it truly to liberate this moment from confusion, from bewilderment, from greed, from hatred, from ill will? So that is where we will start today. So I'd like